Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and Happy New Year, everyone. Welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer, Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter, Christina Laurie, covering Kingston City Council's response to the proposed amalgamation of conservation authorities.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
Council is formally pushing back against the province's plans to amalgamate conservation authorities across Ontario. At a recent meeting, Council passed a motion affirming strong support for the continued independence of the Cataraqui Conservation Authority, an organization that plays a key role in protecting local watersheds, wetlands, shorelines, and biodiversity across the region. The motion was moved by Councillor Gary Osteroff, who highlighted the CCA's long track record of local expertise, fiscal responsibility, and accountability to the communities it serves.
You know, we're sounding the alarm that this is quite a change for us. And so when you're on the board and you see what's happening, it causes alarm. And to have been chair and been involved as deeply as I have for my entire time on council, it's been nothing but inspiring for me to be part of this organization that is incredibly financially good steward of what we've been given. And when you think about what we do in the flood forecasting and the stormwater and everything that is handled, it doesn't get done at a better price. So I just think that we have to be really careful to make these changes, and we just want to bring it to light, and hopefully we are able to make some suggestions and inputs that our government would be listening to.
Beyond environmental protection, the CCA provides essential services including flood forecasting and warnings, drinking water source protection, environmental education, and the management of conservation areas valued by residents. Councillor Don Amos, who seconded the motion, also raised concerns about the province's direction.
Environmental protection is not a one-size-fits-all, and this feels like a Toronto, once again, issue that is being now doled out to the whole province. And the main crux from my observation is that two CAs, or conservation authorities, two CAs sit in certain municipalities, or one municipality, and there seems to be communication and confusion when they have three people sitting together trying to figure out land use planning. And when you get in the minister's ear or the premier's ear about issues, sometimes a full sweep seems to happen. And this, in my observation, this has come into play again. Making five CAs come together to make one massive one on the Eastern region, or the St. Lawrence, if they're calling it that, the St. Lawrence region, is not going to bode well. Right now, this council can call up anyone in the Conservation Authority, have a direct conversation with a staff member. That staff member would know precisely where the counselor is talking about of concern, and can help address that matter. This goes to a regional aspect. The St. Lawrence Conservation Authority, of what they're proposing, could be housed in Ottawa, could be housed in Cornwall, wherever. And now we're reaching out. The board has hinted that it could be 70 members strong. Good heavens, good luck in making a decision on that. There is no way that service levels and community values can happen and go through this When you create a size of a conservation authority of this magnitude, there will be no, from my observations, fiscal responsibility. When you have a forced amalgamation and back office integration, sometimes it works, most times it doesn't, because it's forced. It's not two collaborations coming together. It's an overbody that is saying you will do this. And most times that doesn't end well for anybody, and except the taxpayer ends up paying more. Right now, the city of Kingston is roughly 50% of the Conservation Authority's budget. We are the largest municipality in that realm. Hence, we have four councillors that sit on that board of directors. But I can say wholeheartedly, GM Ellingwood and his team are fiscally responsible. They are doing what they need to do to support the region in anything from land use patterns to environmental risks. And that's because of the relationships that we have built through this council. And I don't see that happening going to a larger entity.
During discussion, several councillors emphasized that amalgamation risks weakening local decision-making. Councillor Brandon Tozo spoke to this alongside other concerning trends in decisions made by the province.
Who's asking for this? Like, who is asking to take away local authority over conservation, make one several larger authorities? Like, where's the advocacy that has been done at a local level for this? I'm reading through the information report earlier was infuriating. Like, each CA has different policies. They have different processes. They have different staffing. Of course they do, because they're dealing with different environmental considerations. And I think we've seen time and time again, this government reduce the power of conservation authorities. And I think this is just another way to further reduce local control and local decision-making over conservation, something that is, we are stewards of the environment for the next generation. This is just absolutely infuriating. I hate the fact that this government, on the big things that we're advocating for, ignores us, and on the little things where we have some degree of say, takes it away. It's just, yeah, this is a lump of coal in Doug Ford's stocking, if I could do it.
Councillors Vincent Shinani and Gregory Ridge also added that opposition isn't just coming from council chambers.
I've actually spoken to a bunch of constituents who actually approached me to talk to me about this and how concerned they were. So, you know, voters are concerned about this, like greatly. It's not just a few people that approach me. So I think it's really important that we keep this local and smaller so that we can make better decisions.
I've had a number of constituents reach out to me to advocate for something like this before the agenda was presented, and so I'm very glad to see that it's here. I do also remind those constituents that this is ultimately a decision that will be made by the province, encourage them to reach out to the member of provincial parliament, in this case, Mr. Hsu. But at our own level, in terms of an advocacy piece, I think this is important to make our position very clear.
The motion also directs the city to formally share its position with the premier, relevant provincial ministers, local MPPs, the Katarakaway Conservation Authority, and municipalities across the watershed, encouraging others to voice similar support. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Jesse. Members of the Gananoque Fire Service were honored last Wednesday evening with Lifesaver Awards in recognition of their actions during two separate medical emergencies that resulted in lives being saved. The awards were presented to Community Safety Officer Dylan Champagne, Platoon Chief Paul Lloyd, Deputy Fire Chief Andrew Kent, Captains Sean Kraft and Kevin Conway, and firefighters Alan Smith, Mackenzie Van Slake, Alex Hutchinson, Tyler Lahivardi, Peter Stocker, and Travis McNeil. A Lifesaver Award is presented when emergency responders treat a patient who has gone into cardiac arrest, and through immediate medical care, the patient recovers well enough to be discharged from hospital. According to the fire service, the two incidents highlighted the importance of rapid response, effective teamwork, and continued medical training. Officials said the actions taken by the members directly changed the outcome of life-threatening emergencies. The Gananoque Fire Service also acknowledged the role of emergency dispatchers, noting their professionalism, coordination, and support play a critical role in successful outcomes during emergency responses. Fire officials said the recognition reflects the dedication and skill of the service's members and underscores the service's commitment to protecting the community and saving lives. Thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with a story from the LJI reporter for YGK News, Owen Fullerton, about an influx of new funding for Resolve Counseling.
Thank you, Dinah. Resolve Counseling Services is one of 20 community-based organizations that are receiving funding from the Department of National Defense's Sexual Misconduct and Resource Center, or SMSRC, to offer free services to members of the defense community who have been impacted by sexual misconduct. Just over 3 years ago, a report put together by Supreme Court Justice Luis Arbour dug into a military culture that Arbour said was rampant with sexual misconduct and a, quote, broken system that the Canadian Armed Forces are incapable of addressing on their own. This round of funding from the DND is a step meant to help address some of these issues that were highlighted in the lengthy report, providing the opportunity for organizations all over Canada to provide free services to current and former CAF members. Resolve Counseling in Kingston will be funded for a three-year period that began in October of 2025 and provides priority counseling services to defense community members who have experienced sexual misconduct, as well as their supporters, free of charge and without a wait list. Executive Director of Resolve Counseling Services, Stafford Murphy, says programs being funded like the one at Resolve are focused on trying to, quote, mitigate some of the harm caused to former and active service members who have experienced sexual misconduct in some form. The organization is receiving $75,000 in each of the next 3 years to provide services to veterans and current members of DND, and Murphy says it will allow Resolve to ensure members of the CAF have access to these services right when they're looking for them, removing as many barriers as possible. Through the grant, Resolve will have a target of approximately 420 sessions delivered per year and are in the process of trying to get the word out about these available services. Murphy says that trying to market those services has been the only real change needed to accommodate the program. Murphy says Resolve was already well suited to provide the services and have done so for other community members in the Kingston area for over 50 years now, saying that the organization would be a good place to take advantage of the grant funding as infrastructure was already in place. Because of that, defense community members who are interested in services can be connected immediately. Although services like this one being offered by Resolve are acknowledged as a need by the CAF after Justice Arbour's 2022 report, Murphy hopes their uptake and the role they can play for defense community members can also help encourage further progress more broadly for mental health care in Canada. Well, he says positive strides have been made both federally and provincially to address gaps in the mental health care system, remarking specifically on investments made in the intimate partner violence sector. There's still a long way to go. With many people in Ontario and other provinces around the country fearing a two-tiered health care system coming to Canada, Murphy says when it comes to mental health care, it's already here. Murphy added that businesses have started to move in a direction of supporting their employees' mental well-being, and that should continue, even if it is primarily due to cost-benefit analyses.
And thank you to Owen Fullerton for that story. Now back over to the LJR reporter for CFRC, Christina Laurie, covering a story about KHSC's year-end fundraiser.
University Hospitals Kingston Foundation, which supports both Kingston Health Sciences Center and Providence Care, is currently leading a landmark fundraising campaign, with anonymous local donors matching community donations by up to $100,000. The Double Your Donation Matching Gift Challenge runs until the end of the year, with matched gifts supporting the most pressing needs across both Kingston Health Sciences Center and Providence Care. Jeff Donner, Director of Marketing and Communications with UHKF, shared more about the Matching Gift Challenge with CFRC.
A matching gift challenge is powerful because it turns one person's generosity into something bigger. Every gift goes a little bit further instantly because of that matching element. And this time of year really highlights how deeply people in Kingston care about one another, especially when it comes to healthcare, especially knowing that we're entering into a very important era of healthcare in city and in the city of Kingston and beyond.
As Donner mentioned, local healthcare is at a pivotal moment, with local hospitals facing evolving demands and major projects on the horizon.
I think what's new this year is the intentionality behind the campaign. Mm-hmm. The news is definitely out there that land has been put aside for a new hospital and innovation complex. More news to come on that, obviously. But I think the most important takeaway from that is
It reinforces how important investment in healthcare is for our region, particularly as we face a very large capital project that will take many, many years to complete. This is sort of our first foray into that type of landscape.
The funds raised through this challenge will also help hospitals respond to today's realities, including growing patient volumes, increasingly complex care needs, and the need for new technologies. From modern equipment and innovative treatments to staff support and system-wide improvements, the campaign helps turn community generosity into direct impact. Lori Fagiani, Director of Engagement and Sustainability with UHKF, emphasized that this is truly a community-driven effort, with donations staying local and directly supporting care close to home.
One of the nice things with working with the foundation is that the funds that we do raise through all of our campaigns and all of the different ways that we raise funds do stay local. So they are here and they are helping our friends, our families, our neighbors. The money that we raise is going to help, you know, you and your family. So that's a really important issue, that knowing that donor donations stay right here in Kingston to help our own community.
Donors can contribute through one-time or recurring gifts by visiting uhkf.ca/give. Once again, gifts made by December 31st, 2025 will be matched dollar for dollar by anonymous local donors, up to $100,000.
You know, as you know, hospitals don't slow down during the holiday. In many ways, needs increase. Community support during this season sends a powerful message to healthcare teams that they're not alone. And I think that's really the spirit of the campaign that we're trying to share with the public is we're here for you. And we invite your support to be here for one another as well through donation and through your participation in our holiday campaign. Every gift helps strengthen care across our hospitals.
Yeah. I was just going to say, it doesn't matter the size of the gift. It's the support. And this is the season of giving. And so big, small, your donations are all greatly appreciated. Again, they will go to support local health care right here in Kingston, supporting our own family, our friends, our neighbors, the people that we know. And that makes a huge difference.
This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you to Christina Laurie for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN, Dan Jones, with a story about Coburg's Trinity United Church.
Hi, I'm Dan Jones with CFWN in Coburg, Ontario. Financial struggles have struck a historic church in Coburg. The 200-year-old Trinity United Church is threatened to close its doors as early as next year, but could survive longer if assets are sold while the church is looking for a new minister. Internal leadership is strategizing on how to right this financial ship. Christine Raby, the secretary of the stewardship committee at the church, speaks with me about the financial difficulties.
This church is incredibly important to this community. It's been around now for officially over 200 years. They celebrated their 200th anniversary just last year. And not only the building itself, but the community of the church has been really an important part of Coburg for a long time. And I mean, I know for me, coming to Coburg as a newbie just a couple of years ago, I was so excited for there to be a United Church in this area because I really think it's important for there to be somewhere that anyone of any faith can go and feel at home in that space. So it's the only one we got. It's an important spot.
So I understand that the church is undergoing some financial struggles.
Mm-hmm.
Can you paint us a picture of where the church is at, how it got there, and possibly what the plans are for the future?
Absolutely. So the church underwent a big financial audit just very recently, and the council's been talking through some of those projections and kind of what's going on and how it got there. The church has been running a deficit for a couple of years now. I think COVID was a really tough time for everyone and for churches especially, right? Having to pivot, having to buy new equipment to start running online services, people not coming into the building as much, not donating, etc. So I think that that was a difficult situation, and the church has been, you know, working and trying to kind of move against that, but hasn't been able to and has been running a deficit since. So now looking at that, the projections going forward are not so great. As far as the report is looking at, you know, they're saying, you know, if we tap into our resources, the church has a housing fund and some other assets, maybe we can be looking towards 2027, but without those extra resources, we wouldn't be necessarily financially sustainable that far even. So it's something that's kind of an urgent need that's been built up over a couple of years, and we're just trying to figure out how we can reconcile that and build a journey to a more sustainable future at the church.
So have you noticed possibly that donations could be down due to the affordability crisis? Some people may not have money to give. Are you seeing that in the church right now?
I mean, absolutely. I think we're seeing that in every sector, but I think also that there are some people that don't attend as regularly maybe as they used to. Life is busy. And I think we really want to try and, you know, remind people of the good that church can bring, that church is important even in our really busy, bustling lives right now, and encourage people to come out and enjoy our services and see what church can provide for them so that they feel like it's worth giving of their time, their talents, and if they can, their finances.
So are you noticing that I guess I'm kind of segueing here, but are you noticing that the congregation population has decreased?
I'm coming in on a relatively short term, if I'm being honest, though I do know that there has been some decline. From what I seem to understand, I think that there's still a really healthy number that come out for some of those big services. We're going into Christmas Eve coming up, those kind of Advent and Lent services have still good attendance. There's still people who call Trinity United Church their congregational home, who consider themselves to be members, but maybe don't make it out on a November Sunday morning. So we're hoping that we can kind of really talk to some of those people and also encourage some members of the community who maybe don't have a faith community and don't understand what that could be as a positive for them, that they might want to come and check it out, because Trinity welcomes everyone. You don't have to be a baptized member to come and enjoy a service, or even to come enjoy some non-worship activities at the church.
So then, has the church undertaken any community engagement to understand why some people come to church and why people don't go to church?
I think that there are a lot of reasons why that happens. I mean, I mentioned just the busyness of life these days. Lifestyle has changed a lot in the last 50 years. And I think the church is trying to do what they can to try and accommodate those changes and try and remain a relevant place for people by offering a little bit of peace in all of that busyness and offering opportunities to enrich the lives of young people as well. I think that there are some stereotypes around that church is for older folks. It's a place for them to have community. But I think we overlook just how big of an impact the church can have on young people as well. And there's some good things going on at Trinity, especially in the music ministry. I'm a music person myself, so I'm a little biased. But as somebody who did grow up in the church, I really see a lot of value in having a place for young people where they can interact with people of all ages, can have kind of a safe space outside of home and school, and kind of build some social skills and also have a place for some spiritual nurture too.
Wonderful. And so then going forward, what's the plan to stabilize the finances and possibly get them into a better position?
I think from what I understand, there's a bit of a multi-prong approach, and the finance committee would maybe be a little bit better equipped to get into the nitty-gritty of it. But I think they're targeting, of course, on one hand, fundraising, continuing to put together fun activities to bring people in. We just had our big Holly Tea and Craft Sale. We are doing community movie nights and suppers. Stewardship Committee is working on our Taste of Trinity fundraiser, where people can enjoy hosting or attending dinners at people's homes. So we are trying to make things happen in that respect, but also trying to bring people in. We have our Christmas services coming up, which are always a special time at the church. So encouraging anybody who wants to come out and enjoy. We've got a lovely Advent 4 service coming up with the Trinity Concert Band, so we'll have some lovely band music this Sunday. And then, of course, our Christmas Eve services, which are geared towards family at 4 p.m. with the children singing and performing their Christmas pageant. And then, of course, a 9 p.m. candlelight service for a little bit more of a serene feeling of the holidays. So just trying to bring people in to enjoy and take part in things, I think, is a big part of the process.
Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
And thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
This is Jesse Bell with the Environment Canada Weather Report for the week. Thursday, January 1st, the first day of the new year, is going to be cold with the remnants of midweek snow still on the ground, possibly another 2 to 4 centimeters falling on January 1st. Friday, January 2nd, we're out of the run of nasty weather here in the city of Kingston. Daytime high of -7 with partly sunny conditions. Overnight low of -12, feeling closer to -13. Saturday, January 3rd, daytime high of -8, overnight low of -16 with sunny conditions. Sunday, January 4th, daytime high of -7, low of -11. And then moving into the start of next week, Monday, January 5th, daytime high of -4 with a 76% chance of light snowfall in the forecast.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office and supported by your friends at Modern City Taxi, we're pleased to present a single by Kentucky called Born American, a song that is both a question and a reflection, urging listeners to consider the human impact of our world's shifting borders and systems. With vivid imagery and raw emotion, the song and its accompanying video invite you to feel deeply and reflect on compassion and understanding. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Born American by Kentucky on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
In the hospital, all alone in the middle of the night, a lonely mother gave her life. A nurse drove the dead woman's hair. American. Oh, they could not know they would be called to the street and called to defend their sons and daughters. From the men with the masks and the jackets that say ICE, you better come and eat. It's your birthright in the land of the free. Men don't mean nothing even though you were born American. Just a few of the ways that people in his town could tell that he was born American.
He was quick to fight, but he was also quick to forgive. He was cool, and he was handsome.
Oh, they could not know they would be called to the street and called to defend their sons and daughters.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. This is edition 298. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thank you for tuning in. On the broadcast this week, I speak with Enrique Parrara, who is a teacher in Sao Paulo at the Federal University, and I think is an important social movement-aligned educator that is thinking about questions of social movements and digital technologies in the context of Latin America. So in the Brazilian context, we're talking about the dynamics of American tech giants influencing and creating political weight in Brazil. We've seen the left government of the Workers' Party of Brazil at odds with a social media corporation like X, which was playing out political influence in the context of Brazilian politics. And so Enrique and others are really putting forth this idea of digital sovereignty. And I think this is a term that's been really present in progressive thinking in Brazil today. We hear about what this means. We also hear about what does an open internet mean, or free accessible research on an open internet mean, when you have private AI companies, corporations harvesting that information for profit. These are the questions that we talk about today. And so it's really a pleasure to share my conversation with Enrique Parrara at the Federal University in Sao Paulo on this week's edition of Free City Radio. Here it is. Addressing the contemporary reality in relation to power dynamics in the world between U.S.-based tech companies and figures like Elon Musk, connected, you know, for a considerable time deeply with the current authoritarian government of Donald Trump. Addressing figures like that in relation to global politics is important. This does take place, of course, in mainstream media platforms, but I think it's important to hear voices that can offer a perspective on this from the global south, to look at alternative frameworks of understanding digital and online infrastructure today. Enrique Parrara is a researcher and educator in Sao Paulo and co-authored recently a paper that's called The Digital and the South Questionings. And this is the second volume. Enrique, thank you so much for being here. I'm wondering if you could first start by introducing yourself.
Hi, Stefan. First, thank you very much for the invitation. It's nice to be here with you. And I'm in Sao Paulo right now. I work as a professor in the social science department at the Federal University of Sao Paulo, where we have a lab which is called Pimenta Lab, which is dedicated to investigate the field of technopolitics. So pretty much we work in two big directions. I mean, the way digital technologies and technologies of communication, how they have been participating in important changes in the way we produce, circulate it, and how you produce knowledge, basically. And at the same time, how it's participated in changes in economics and politics. I mean, the power relations, right? So we pretty much work in these two directions. And that's it. We have like different fields of empirical research.
Clearly, there's a major focus that has recently been in the news, which is, you know, at the highest levels of state power, the conflict between the Workers' Party government in Brazil and Elon Musk. Of course, there's a historical context to understanding the Workers' Party that first came to power with the support of social movements in the early 2000s. And, you know, I think it'd be interesting to hear your perspective on this contemporary international news issue, but from the ground, from your vantage point in Sao Paulo. So, yeah, I'll leave it there.
Yeah, we are in a very different moment than we were 20, 25 years ago when we had the first Works Party presidential government, right? And at that time, we also had a very different situation regarding the grassroots organizations and also digital technology and internet. I mean, it was a complete different environment. Nowadays, we are facing really different challenges. And first of all, I mean, we're dealing with international wave of uprising of extreme right movements. And that's not different in Brazil. And at the same time, we are Brazilian government, it's dealing with a very different context. I mean, we have a National Congress, which is very conservative. It's very extreme right orientated. And it's basically support by the agribusiness, by evangelicals, religious orientated groups, very conservatives, and also by groups related to the military. I mean, we have an arrangement where the extractivist economy, right, agribusiness and mining, energy, and are supporting this Congress, and also the religious groups and the military operators, right? So its government is facing a really strong opposition, and it's really hard to implement its politics. But at the same time, Works Party has changed a lot, in 20 years, right? So today, there is a very important challenge towards all the communication ecosystem and how the political positions, how thinking, how the production of reality is being managed in our society. And it's the same thing in other parts of the world, right? And here, it's especially, it becomes, I mean, outside the U.S. or other countries, it becomes especially harder because we deal with even more asymmetric relation towards, like, the big tech companies, right? So now there is this strong debate that is becoming more interesting regarding the theme of digital sovereignty. So right now, many social movements in Brazil are interested in talk about digital sovereignty. This vocabulary, it's becoming more present in nowadays debates, right? And at the same time, this debate starts to get informed by an environmental issue. So that's the, I think, a new thing, right? So how the traditional social movements are more concerned now with the digital technology environment. That's something that social movements have been always aware, but most of the traditional movements, they were not very well concerned with the capacity to have their own infrastructure, to have their own means of communications, right? So now it's very clear how this corporate communication infrastructure works for the production of a more conservative and extreme right political positions. So it has been more more common and more diffuse, the initiatives towards promote the debate regarding autonomy and digital sovereignty in Brazil, right? At the same time, there's the what I think it's interesting. It's how this debate starts, and that's still it's a beginning of something to have new connections with the environmental debate, right? So just to give an example, I mean, we're talking about the importance of having our own data centers. Right, because we don't want our data to be in Amazon, no? Or Azure or other big tech companies outside of Brazil, or even to have their data centers in Brazil to have control of our data. But then we have to think about the energy impact, right? We have to think about water use for those data centers. Where those data centers are gonna be? So these are kind of new questions that before were not present when we were debating questions regarding digital technologies, right? So that's something new.
I also wanted to speak to you about the framework of open publishing. Now, you have a meaningful connection to social movements, particularly in Latin America, around what was called the global justice movement. So this was, you know, protests taking place to oppose the imposition of neoliberal economic policies, financialization, and that was strongly mobilized against in many contexts globally. Part of that process led to the creation of different platforms online in the early 2000s. One of them was indymedia.org that was part of this process and really put forth the idea of an open publishing framework online. The dynamics today are different when thinking about the power of tools and also the corporations behind different AI models and commodifying information in the framework of an open internet. Also the fact that, you know, these social media corporations have really commodified this framework of open publishing. So I just wanted to leave some space for you to speak on this, and I'd love to hear your reflections on it. Thank you.
Okay, I think this is some kind of the crossroads, right? Crossroads regarding open access and open access to knowledge, right? 20, 25 years ago, we were really concerned about how to make things open and freely available through internet, right? At the same time, the old economic business that have been developed with the capacity to extract, control, and create new forms of production of value and produce a new form of knowledge control over what has been openly available on the internet, right? So I think the question of how we do nowadays is not anymore just a question of how anyone should be able to produce and put content in circulations, but how we somehow create a commons knowledge economy regulating these forms of access control and exploration and new forms of control of the information, right? So I think the production, how we can deal with a more democratic, open, and emancipatory forms of access to knowledge and to produce it collaboratively implies in creating other forms of governance of this, let's say, data commons, right? And that's not really simple because we have to deal with different stacks, right? Different dimensions of everything that is involved in an information economy. For example, nowadays, Brazil and Latin America, and especially in Brazil, we have very important databases for all academic production. We have a very strong policy in open access for scientific production that has been financed with public funds, right? And so all theses, all articles, most of this stuff, it's freely open on the internet. And then when you see what's happening with the training of the AI machines, I mean, they're being able to explore and training their AI systems to create very strong service that are going to be now sell it to our universities, to our government in order to supply new service, right? So this is something very trivial, right? That is happening in the sense that whatever have the power, right, to analyze, concentrate, training their softwares, it's going to be ahead, right? So the open production of technology, I mean, we have to face different issues now, right? So, I mean, I don't think if I put it in the right way, because it's that we need to create forms of common governance of this knowledge, right? In order to block, I mean, the possibility that it has extraction and control that creates something that's going to be used especially against us, right? So I mean, I think that's a crossroad. I mean, it's hard to define how we can deal with it. But that's when comes, I mean, the question over sovereignty, right? So what does it mean? I mean, is to have the control over your data? I mean, how we develop forms of collective responsibility and the possibility of collective benefit from it?
You so correctly identified the power of the importance of listening to social movement perspectives from the Global South, digital sovereignty. You've put forth this idea. I'd love to hear more about its meaning and the context around this. I think that it's an important framework, and the link that you make to thinking about alternative infrastructures that are necessary in the online world in relation to also the considerations and the urgency of the climate justice movement. So I'll leave some space on that point also.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking about the way, how we could move from a debate on technopolitics to think about in terms of cosmotechnic conflictuality, right? So when we start to think about digital technologies, the struggles we have over it, if we try to insert or combine it with the discussion of modes of existence, forms of life, right? And how we could think it in the introductions of other variables outside of the questions of the economic efficiency model, speed, and I mean other rationalities, right? So I think that now it's very clear that the way digital technology became a kind of ubiquitous presence and it's pretty much working as an environment, right? It's interesting to think, though, the kind of challenges we have when you think about climate change, when you think about the problems related to the environment, there's a very interesting connection to think on the challenges that we face in the development of technologies. I mean, we're saying that the questioning regarding digital technologies now, if we start to approach it also from an environmental perspective, it becomes unavoidable the fact that we have to confront the modes, the economic rationality, and the forms of life that they are promoting. I mean, it's not just a matter of having the same technology to compete in geopolitical or intercapitalistic economic race. And it's important to how we can transform and create other rationalities with this technology. I mean, in the certain sense, they're going to become other kinds of technologies, right? And because they can be orientated by other values, by other cosmovisions, right? So what we've been working on nowadays, I mean, since the pandemic, I think, I mean, the pandemic for us was, we tried to interpret it as the first technopolitical event that has been lived in a synchronized experience in the planetary experience history, right? So with the pandemic, it's pretty much clear that the way our technology, our science, and how our economic and how the geopolitical, they're being interviewed in the production of our crisis, right? So for us now, everything that we've been researching regarding digital technology has to be confront with this other dimension, which is the geo-history, with these the things related to the capitalocene, right? And so it's not just that, that's because the debate over sovereignty technology becomes more complicated, because even the concept of sovereignty, which is usually very state-centric, become more complicated because we cannot have the solutions only at the state level, right? And the same thing with the climate change thing, and the same thing with the development of technology. So somehow we are using this vocabulary, I mean, talking about digital sovereignty, but it has to be clear that we're not talking about the same idea of national state-centric sovereignty policies, right? So what that means in terms of development of technology, with development of infrastructure, when we start to pose this question, it becomes more complicated, right? So yeah, I think this is a kind of issues that we want to introduce, because when you're debating energy transition, right? I mean, now there's all this big wave on renewable energies in Brazil, right? But with the expansion of AI systems, I mean, we're demanding a lot more energy, right? So we're going to have to make very strong decisions, very strong collective, very strong choice in terms of what we need, right? And that's that. I mean, and that's when questions regarding democracy becomes more interesting, because it becomes a question also of dealing with other forms of life that are not integrated in our democratic system.
Henrique, you have really outlined some of the critical points for people involved in this intersection of environmental justice work, digital technologies, and social movements need to consider. We'll link to this recent publication that you shared, The Digital and the South Questionings. It's the second volume. In the links for this program, which are at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. If you're hearing that on a campus or community station in Canada, you can visit that website to find more information. Henrique, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today from Sao Paulo.
Thank you, Stefan.
That was a conversation with Henrique Parada, who is a researcher and educator and author based in Sao Paulo. He teaches at the Federal University and has recently published a really interesting paper called The Digital and the South, Questionings. As you heard, this interview, I think, accurately addresses some deep questions about what digital sovereignty means in an era of tech giants and corporate digital platforms based in the United States. What does it look like for a global South country to declare digital sovereignty? Important questions. Thank you so much to Henrique for being on the program today. This has been another edition of Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in. And thank you to the Social Justice Center at Concordia University for supporting this project. We broadcast weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m. on CJLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal on Wednesdays at 8 a.m. on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m. on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m. on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m. on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Thursdays at 4:30 p.m. and on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. Thanks so much for tuning in. And you can also look us up as a podcast. Just search Free City Radio. I'll speak to you next week. Thanks for listening.